This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Helen Farmer with you, and loads to talk about on today's episode. How should you respond if your child has been exposed to explicit content, whether that is of an adult nature or indeed horror films and more that many of us faced in our childhood? We were speaking to a cybersecurity expert and a psychologist about the impact on brain, relationships and the tech that you need to know about. We were also celebrating World Bicycle Day with a woman who's really flying the flag for women's sport in the region, Dawn Barnable, on the show. House and House shining a light on Palm Jumeirah, buying, selling and what is happening at the point. And in our legal clinic, it was Tenji Moyo helping out with all aspects of employment law, from that new mental health law that's just been brought in, to answering your questions. A survey out of the UK revealed that almost a quarter of parents admit they're not as aware as they would like to be about how their children are spending their time online. So are you concerned? Should you be concerned? We're going to be talking about the impact that inappropriate explicit images, content can have on our children's brains, their relationships, even the brain development. Now, though, we're talking about what we can do about it. We have lead security researcher, global research analysis team at Kaspersky. Maha is specialised in cyber threat intelligence, incident response. We can talk about internet risks for children and teens. We can talk about inappropriate content, extortion, and, of course, what we can do about it. How are you?
Good afternoon.
I've got so many questions for you, and I know the text lines are going to be busy as well. I feel like it's a very difficult one to try and navigate, because the easy, you know, knee-jerk answer is go, well, get kids off devices. You know, ban smartphones, ban iPads, let's go back in time. It's simply not realistic right now. And I think, you know, much like in Jurassic Park, life finds a way, much now in real life, children find a way. And that can look like, you know, magazines in years gone by. It can look like, you know, watching horror films in your friend's bedroom when the parents didn't know what you were watching. It takes many different forms. But I wanted to ask you, with the increasing amount of time that children and teens are spending online, what are some of the most effective ways that parents can protect them from inappropriate content?
Sure. So, first of all, we have to understand the context of the internet risks, right? So we know what's out there, what's the most common risks, what's the most common issues that they may face on the internet, so we can protect against them. And that's basically how we look at the threat landscape for the children and for the kids and for the teens even. First of all, we need to understand that, as you mentioned, it's inevitable. At some point, they will be exposed to something. So the best approach, to be honest, is awareness. Being proactive in responding to such situations, meaning we need to educate them, make them understand that things can happen, and we need them to report as early as possible. Mm-hmm. So transparency is key. And detection at the early stage is very important in such situations, because one of the risks, for example, is cyberbullying or scamming or even extortion. We have seen quite often at some point. Extortion in the sense someone may hack the device of the child and they may infect it with malware and then try to photograph or record the voice of a teenager, for example, and then try to extort them at some point in time. So these kind of things are important. I know that it's sometimes hard for even the teens or the children, but if we have such proactive measures by telling them that things can happen, we need to detect it as soon as possible so we can respond as soon as mm-hmm. possible. Because if things get worse in due course, it gets more complicated and it becomes very hard to fix the issues.
So having what can be quite uncomfortable conversations, absolutely key. You know, this is something that we as parents need to, you know, be part of that conversation. You can't think, oh, that's something that school's going to deal with. You know, these conversations need to be happening in the home in terms of, you are most likely going to be exposed to something. A child might show you, you know, a phone in the playground, or you might be forwarded something, or you might be added to a WhatsApp group. Like, these things happen on a very regular basis. I know they're happening in Dubai. I've got friends with older children who have had some very distressed children coming home from school, having seen something that was absolutely not age appropriate. So having them feel comfortable to come to us as parents and say, this is what happened today, this is why I'm upset, or showing to say, I've been added to this, this is what I've seen, and then that early reporting. You mentioned there malware, cracked software. What kind of software or even parental controls can actually help in this, help monitor, restrict access to harmful content on the internet? Are there any URLs, any apps that, you know, could be quite useful for us to be aware of, download, familiarize ourselves with?
Sure. I mean, the issue is several parts, right? So you mentioned one that is also common. Someone invites you randomly to a group, and then they start sending photos or inappropriate content. Even I've seen and I've investigated the case here in the UAE where there was someone impersonating another person, actually teens, and sending inappropriate content to another friend, and then things can go wrong really quick.
We can be somewhat blunt about this. I've heard this from a number of people saying, thought they were chatting to another teenager. She sent him a picture of herself, said, now you need to send a picture of me, of you. Now I've got this photo of you. And this is often where the extortion, blackmail, severe mental health problems, to be honest, can really start to unravel. These things happen. They happen far more commonly than we would like to admit.
Of course. And it doesn't need to be like a real stranger. I've seen cases that happens in school between friends, but they don't know that that friend has been sending those pictures until there's an investigation that kicks in. But the point is, there are several areas that we can really work on. First of all, as we mentioned, the early detection, the transparency, the private conversation at home that we can do. The early, the better. Now, the second part is each social media. Of course, there's the threat actor, if we want to say, and the medium that's being used to communicate with the victim, who is the child or the teenager. The medium itself is mostly social media or instant messaging. And these kind of applications have really important configuration or settings that we can enable. For example, we just talked about a random person adding us to a random group and then sending inappropriate content. So there's a settings in instant messaging applications that can prohibit or prevent anyone that is not a contact and in our contact list to allow him or her to add us to that group. So meaning not anyone can then out of nowhere or randomly adding us to a group. It has to be in our contact list. And that minimize and really narrow down the potential and limit even the risk of having inappropriate, being added to an inappropriate groups. That's
also
important.
Also airdrop as well. This is another means I'm hearing a lot of people, you know, on, you know, teens, kids on the school bus being airdropped images and videos. And again, you can adjust your settings there to say, unless we're contact, you can't send me anything.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the first step I would think of is really understanding what are the apps that are installed on the phones, the settings that we can enable on the phone and on the apps itself. Because really, they can limit the attack surface.
We've got Mahavi Amut with us today, specialised in cyber threat intelligence, instant response from the team at Kapersky, and the text lines are open. Gloria saying, kids will always find a way to access what is forbidden. Most important thing is talking to them about AI, Photoshop, being respectful of each other. This isn't going to go away. Message here saying, I always check my 12-year-old son's WhatsApp groups for grooming, bullying. He knows I do it. I do it in front of him. I've looked recently and was really shocked by the nature of the conversations. The group chat's about 6 or 7 of them, all boys, lots of memes and emojis, but no images. It seems like silly talk. I'm not concerned they're doing any of this. They don't use Snapchat or social media. They play Roblox games together, but still seem quite young. I feel uncomfortable reading the messages of these kids, and I don't know if this is just normal now. They're only year 7s, and this time last year, that he was still an innocent child. Do you think that kids are growing up faster now as a result of this?
Well, obviously. And, you know, in the past, we barely grew up with social media. Now they are actually starting with social media from their early life. So they are definitely growing faster. And technology is also going there with them in parallel. Mm. But it's on our shoulders to be faster, at a faster pace, so we can understand the technology, try to equip ourselves with the defenses required, and so we can make them aware of what can go wrong, so we can better minimize the impact at some point.
It's a bit of a tough order, though, for us to try and stay ahead of the tech than our kids. truthfully speaking, like, it's a real conscious choice to educate yourself, to tune in, because it's very easy to be dismissive of platforms, you know, of certain games, and go, oh, that's for kids, that's for young people, that's not for me. And it might not be for you, it might not be something that you use and enjoy, but as parents we do need to be aware of it, because unfortunately, and not to be too dark about it, you know, it is in these gaps in our knowledge where predators prey. You know, we need to be fully informed. Message here from Beck saying, when should you inform the school if it's a WhatsApp group of school friends with explicit images?
I mean, if it's known that it's a group from people from or friends from the school, definitely you should report them. If it's too much, I will take evidence and then I will block and report the group. But also take the right evidence so you can have your own proof, the evidence to talk with the schools and so on and so forth. Or you can just, before you block and report, make sure you I don't want to confiscate the phone, but at least preserve it so you can show the real evidence to the school. Mm-hmm. And then they can conduct their own investigation. Obviously, there's nowadays a lot of rules with schools and universities that are really well mentioned about cyberbullying and the consequences of it and how they should proceed with the investigation and so forth.
Mark, we're running out of time, but based on your information you have at Kaspersky, the conversations you're hearing from people within the industry, but also parents and just members of the public, is there anything that you feel people listening and watching today have to know in order to protect their children and teens from inevitable threats? What would you love to have everybody know of or indeed put in place?
Sure. I mean, I would start that by saying and repeating what we have just said. It's inevitable. So better to be understanding of how things work. Make sure that we have the right settings in place so we can prevent anyone from randomly dropping or adding things to our children's mobile. There are tools out there, Kaspersky Safe Kids. It's a parental control application you can install, and then it can monitor for abnormal stuff. It can report, even it can block certain things as well. It really depends on the age. Sometimes transparency is important and key. Anyway, early detection is important in these kind of things. But really, we need to understand the threat landscape out there. And accordingly, we'll have additional sessions, hopefully, in the future, so we can explain more about these kind of threats and how to mitigate each one of them alone.
It's a lot. It's a lot. But it's good to know there are things in place. But as I said, it's these kind of conversations that raise awareness. You know, if someone wants to share this podcast, send it to a partner, a family member, a child. You know, if this sparks just one conversation around the dinner table or a WhatsApp conversation, dare I say it, about we need to be more aware, then, you know, we're doing good work today. Mar, thank you so much for your time today. Really, really appreciate it. And we're going to be talking next with a psychologist about the impact on the brain, on developments, about perceptions around relationships and intimacy. We've also had messages about horror films as well. We've had messages coming in concerned parents about so-called inappropriate content that their children, their teens are accessing. As we heard earlier from our cyber expert from Kaspersky, this is inevitable. You know, I wish I could wave a magic wand and say, if you download this app, then your child will remain young and innocent and wide-eyed until their 18th birthday, when they will be emotionally prepared to deal with such content. This is not going to happen. Your child will be forwarded things. They will be shown things. Maybe, as we've heard from a number of people, it's going to be their friends that are showing them horror films or adult content. This is inevitable. The most important thing I can say to you at this point is to have conversations with our kids. And I would say that starting earlier than you probably think, and keep those communication lines open. As we touched on in a previous show, where one young man in the UK was extorted over images that were taken of him unknowingly from his laptop camera. It was only because he felt in a position to reach out to his parents and say, this is happening, that they were able to take the situation under control. So the consequences can be absolutely catastrophic if your child is being extorted over explicit images. We've unfortunately seen two teenage boys in the UK taking their life, and it is teenage boys where this is happening the most. So we're taking it very seriously here at the station. But truthfully, if this conversation leads to further conversations with you, with friends, sharing the podcast with partners, then I'm genuinely grateful. I'm really grateful to get expert take on this. And speaking to us now from Thrive Wellbeing Centre, Dr. Marina, psychologist, sharing thoughts on what happens to our children's brain, what happens to their development, what happens to relationships, and maybe even their perception of intimacy in relationships. Dr. Marina, thank you for joining us today. How are you?
Thank you, Helen. I'm very good. Thank you so much for asking. It's always nice to connect with you again.
It is. I'm really glad to get your take on this because I wanted to ask you about that child brain development piece because, you know, research now showing that young people's brains are not actually fully developed until they're 25, which explains all sorts of, you know, behaviours, shall we say. But what about a child being exposed to inappropriate, explicit content at a young age? Do we have any research on the impact that can have on the brain?
So from a scientific perspective or from a biological perspective, of course, there's a lot of things that are not developed yet in the brain of those little kids. But from a very different angle, we can say that emotionally, even cognitively, there's a lot of things that are changing. Like when a child sees something, whether it's a picture or a scene or anything that's a bit disturbing, so they either go through confusion, uncertainty, shame or guilt. Sometimes it's shock, sometimes it's disgust, sometimes it's sadness, and sometimes, interestingly, obviously, there's excitement and happiness, because a lot of times these scenes can be very new. And they can be exciting a bit, if that's the right word to say it here on the radio. But it does create this turbulent and confused state of mind because it's very new for the child and the child is unaware of, okay, how do I react to this? Is this okay? Is this not okay? Do I want to see more? Or, oh my God, I need to panic and I just need to... Exactly. And every child does react differently. That's a very important point to make. Mm-hmm. We cannot generalize any of this conversation. It all depends on the family. It depends on early exposure to information such as, let's say, sexual education, knowledge of your body, knowledge of how the person, you know, where did I come from, for example? Yeah. A lot of times we know kids ask this question. And on that note, I have this book that I recommend for... Usually parents who have children who are exposed to such material and for appropriate sexual education, because a lot of times the school doesn't teach us a lot about what we need to know. A lot
point.
Of times.
Yeah, it's called Where Did I Come From? So if you want to send me the word book, I will happily send you the word link. It's interesting because our school had an opt-in session for the girls on puberty last week, and it led to some very interesting conversations in the WhatsApp group. Let's just say that I can't talk about it on air. But yes, kids are definitely talking about more than we think they are. So when we're talking about so-called inappropriate content, Dr. Marine, I think there's kind of two things we're talking about. One is that adult content you were referencing there, and the other is scary stuff, horror films, which, I mean, I don't think I'm going to tell you what's happening in the studio right now. There are five screens next to me. There is news going on. There is the clock going on. There's adverts. There's a movie going on. Silence of the Lambs was on that screen a few months ago, and I couldn't look at it because when I was 10, my friend Annabelle held me down by my shoulders and basically forced me to watch Silence of the Lambs when I was about 10 or 11. And it genuinely terrified me for years and years and years. So what about that horror aspect as well? Because, you know, I don't know if things have technically got more gory or more suspenseful or become desensitized, so the film industry needs to be, you know, upping the ante more and more and more. Is that something that can come into clinic with you guys at Thrive, where children have been traumatized by some content that they might have seen from a horror point of view?
See, Helen, I think the root of anxiety in general, or the root of fear in general, it is definitely not just a real life experience, but actually TVs, media. I'm noticing that every single cartoon that my son is watching, for example, there has to be some darkness, there has to be some monsters, there has to be a villain, there has to be a vampire, there has to be always something which is creating this fear, even if the child is, you know, happy and content and safe within his environment. So these kinds of anxiety triggering situations, I feel I can only blame the social media. I can only blame people who make these movies. I can only blame people who create such horror stories at a specific period of time when children are able to differentiate between what's fictitious and what's real. They need some time to grow older. They need some time to mature. So at an earlier age, let's say 5, 6, 7, I think they're still tiny. They're not able to really differentiate that, oh, you know what? Monsters are definitely fake. Monsters are definitely the creation of some artist. So I personally do struggle with this within my home environment because the other day we were watching I don't remember. Was it actually, maybe it was a very old version of The Jungle Book, maybe. And I noticed that the scary depiction of certain animals in the movie, they were really scary. And, you know, let's talk about kids and loving animals. So obviously.
Very true. I just want to come to a couple of messages we've got. Dr. Marina. Victoria saying, please. I watched a lot of horror films as a 9, 10, 11 year old. Can't say it affected me too badly. I think I realised it was made up and moved on. But maybe today our brains don't have time to recalibrate because we're watching things 24/7. Interesting. So kind of information overload. Bilal says, my aunt and uncle took me to see a double bill of Jaws and Jaws 2 when I was about 8. We had to leave before the second one started. Couldn't get me in the bath for weeks. Can I ask about the impact on self-esteem, body image, identity, if a child is exposed to explicit content online? Is that something that you've seen any research into or even anecdotally?
Helen, do you mind if we clarify a little bit about explicit itself? Are we addressing more the horror, scary stuff, or are we talking about more of inappropriate conversations? Or
no, I'm talking about body. That's a very good point, because I think that's actually a good conversation for another day in terms of issues that a lot of, especially boys and young men, are having about unrealistic expectations about relationships and intimacy. But I think this idea of maybe feeling shame attached to having seen things like that, you know, blaming, feeling insecure, feeling isolated, not being able to have conversations with parents about having been exposed to things that they perhaps know they shouldn't have been. Is there anything you can speak to on that?
So basically, you know, it's a very tough one, because it all depends on the family's dynamic and how they want to expose their kids. A lot of times parents have no clue about what the kids are seeing, what the kids are watching, what the kids are playing, and what kind of conversations they're having with their, you know, school friends, neighbors, and such. So I think when it comes to explicit pictures or content, it's important. I always believe in early intervention more as a preventative method rather than, you know, like just early exposure, because sometimes early exposure can be actually flooding and very harmful to the human little brain. So things like, I think, talking about what's fake, what's real, talking about, you know, what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, or talking even about normal development, how the body changes, how things change, how clothing changes the way we look. And all of these things, I think, can be related to someone's self-esteem, ability to be resilient, and ability to fit in the society that is extremely demanding.
Thank you so, so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Dr. Mina speaking to us from Thrive Wellbeing Centre. If you'd like Dr. Marina's details, you can just send me the word doctor, and I've got loads of people asking for your book. Right here, right now, we have the pleasure of welcoming an extraordinary guest whose story of transformation, determination, passion for cycling is truthfully nothing short of inspirational. It is World Bicycle Day. Dawn Barnable with us today has gone from non-cyclist to ultra-cyclist in just a few months, embarking on a journey that not only changed her life, but has also led her to be a champion for women's sport. Dawn, what's on your t-shirt?
Everyone loves women's sports.
Love it. Where did the t-shirt come from?
Oh, well, we might have made it at the
Good
metal set.
Good for you. Good for you. Tell us what the metal set is.
So the metal set is a multimedia platform that focuses on underrepresented athletes and underreported sports. And by virtue of that focus, we are one of the first and only sports media platforms to put women in sport in the region.
Love it. We're going to be talking about women in sport. I want to talk about you first, though. Sure. Tell us how you went from what you describe as a non-cyclist to ultra-cyclist. It was just 3 months. What motivated that transformation? Or what happened?
I would say stubbornness.
Oh, really?
When was it? Back in 2018. I had gone my entire life. I grew up playing sports, but I was always the worst person in the class, like the worst one to get picked in a team, the worst one in a CrossFit class. And I always had a vision that I would love to do something big athletically, but being, you know, the worst, it seemed kind of out of reach.
And yeah, isn't that funny that, because I think a lot of people identify with what you're saying. Mm. Like gym anxiety is real.
Yeah.
And I have been that person in the class where I'm like, oh, I really am letting the side down right now. And I'm actually not enjoying it so much. But it takes massive perseverance, either keep going back the same class and kind of master it, or to think, okay, this isn't for me, but what next? What else?
What next? Exactly. And so how I found ultra cycling was a friend of mine had done the Transcontinental, which is a 4,000 kilometer race across Europe.
What? I can't even begin to think about the logistics of that. Okay. So you know someone who's probably truly insane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he got back from this race and he was super happy, like on a high. He had weird tan lines. He was laughing, you know, saying it was the best and hardest thing he had ever done. Weird tan lines, laughing about sleeping in parks, getting chased by dogs. And I was like, there's something, maybe there's something to this. And I asked him one night, I said, Chris, do you think I could do something like that? And he said, he didn't miss a beat. And he said, of course you could. You just have to train. Mm-hmm. So I actually had it in my mind to do a 4,000 kilometer race.
That was the goal from the outset.
That was the goal from the outset.
It wasn't like a quick loop around Alcudra.
No. That was the goal. And I mean, a couple of things transpired and I didn't end up doing the 4,000 kilometer race. I didn't fill out the application correctly. But what happened was I started training. Well, first of all, this was in France. So I got back to Dubai and kind of faffed around for a little bit, like didn't really, you know, had it in my mind, but I've got 8 months to train because it was this 4,000 kilometer race. So started to rent a bike going out to El Quidra. I think the first time I couldn't even figure out how to change the gears. So I went single speed around El Quidra. The second time I went, I got sick and I ended up signing up for a couple of shorter races that were quote unquote practice. So 1,000 kilometers race.
Conceptualize what 1,000 kilometers would look like in terms of from somewhere to somewhere, like city or, you know, distance wise. Like, that's mind blowing to me.
Yeah, I think you could probably do the length of the UAE. I think the length of the UAE is probably less because this race was in Oman and it was like a big, huge loop in Oman. I just kind of was, you know, like messing about, going out on the, didn't have a bike. And then I said, okay, I didn't get into this bigger race. And I said, okay, now you've got two races, a race you've signed up for and you need to start training. So I bought a bike. This was early December and just went all in, focused, went, you know, upped my kilometers every weekend from 50 to 70 to 120, 140, 200, and then added elevation into that. And then did the race end of February in 2019. Yeah.
Wow. And you haven't really got off the bike since. And you really also become, as I said, a real champion for women's sport in person, but, you know, online with Metal Set as well. You've reached listeners in over 100 countries now, ranking really highly. What do you think is it about that podcast that's really resonating with the audience? What is it about your message?
I think there's a big niche and there's a need for more women's sports coverage. We are in such a special time in this region when it comes to women achieving amazing things, breaking barriers and history, you know, creating history. And nobody's really documenting it in the way that we are with the medal set. I think, you know, sports media coverage, if 3 years ago was 4% of all sports coverage,
only 4% was 4%, women's sport.
And that's triple to 15. But these figures are from Western markets. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I have a sneaky look today on the sports media pages, and you can barely see a woman's face at all. With the Medal Set podcast, I think, too, there's something special about it. I mean, we're having a chat here. There's something special about long-form conversations. Mm-hmm. I think historically when people were sharing stories in sport and women's stories as well, you can't fully grasp the full story. And these stories have so many twists and turns. Like, women in sport don't have a linear journey. Mm-hmm.
It's that wobbly line.
Yeah, that wobbly line.
And some of that has to do with your own, as you were talking about there, your own fitness, your own breakthroughs, your identity. But so much of it is to do with sponsorship and business and things being opened up. And so it's internal and it's external, which is why I think it has been so stop-start. But I feel like there have, as you say, there's been triple the coverage, but there have been some really pivotal moments in women's sport, certainly in the public eye over the last few years, that have really, really changed the conversation and the interest. I just said to you off air there, one of my best friends' little girls is about 8, and she's an mm-hmm. incredible, incredible football player. So she plays on the boys' team at her school. She plays county on the boys' team. She's in two girls' teams, and she went to watch the Lionesses at St. James's Park on Friday night. And my friend Rach was like, the atmosphere was amazing. First mm-hmm. of all, it was sold out, completely sold out. Ticket prices were understandably less than for men's, but she said it's sold out, real family-friendly atmosphere, no violence, no bad language, everyone being very supportive, still competitive, mm-hmm. but a completely different atmosphere. What do you think's happened over the last few years that is starting to change the conversation, Dawn?
Well, I think people are recognizing that this isn't charity. Women's sports is not charity. It's a really good investment. And the need and want is there. And I think, brands are still playing catch up. Every woman that we speak to on the podcast cites sponsorship as an issue. Male professional athletes earn 24 times more the amount of sponsorship, but women athletes drive twice as more engagement. 89% of sports fans said they're more inclined to take action when a brand aligns itself to a woman in sport.
Oh, it's got goosebumps. Come on, brands, wake up. Dawn Bonneville with us today. She is the managing director of the B Collective. She's an ultra cyclist and the woman behind the Medal Set. Get on your bike. We're marking World Bicycle today. Dawn Bonneville with us in the studio. She's an ultra cyclist. She's also the force behind the Medal Set podcast and indeed a force to be reckoned with when it comes to championing women's sports. Now, you said before the reach of the podcast and the social media, Dawn, is absolutely huge. Mm-hmm. What are some of the conversations you've had recently that you think more people should be hearing? Who's really inspired you?
I mean, everyone. Every time I interview a guest, I come away learning something new and really, really inspired. I think the problem is for me, I just want to try all of these sports.
More gear in the garage.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, maybe I'll do mountaineering.
Come climb a mountain with me.
I'm in.
So are the cyclists as well?
Yeah, so we've had quite a few cyclists, actually. And I've started a second podcast, the Just Bikes podcast, which has done really, really well. But in terms of cyclists in this region, we recently had Maroja Dil, who is Saudi Arabia's first pro cyclist. And she is amazing. She's a joyful, funny, wonderful personality who went from non-cyclist to pro cyclist in about 2 years.
Wow.
She is on the Liv Alula Jaco women's continental team now. She lives in Girona. And she didn't know how to ride a bike 2 years ago.
Amazing. I love this.
Yeah.
Now, just earlier, Dawn, you mentioned some of the challenges in sponsorship for women, talking there about how the engagement is high, but the spend is low. There is a clear need for more investment in
Absolutely.
Women's sports. Where do you think the challenges and I guess the opportunities lie in this area in particular, in the MENA region?
I think there's some legacy issues. I think brands, it takes a brave brand to kind of step out of the norm and do something that they haven't done before. I think people, some of the brands are quite short-sighted. They're looking at reach right now and you're not looking at the potential growth. Mm-hmm. As I said, this is such a historic moment and brands have a real opportunity to align not just, not just reach new audiences, but actually align and cement their place in history when it comes to women's sports in this region. And they're not doing it yet. It's quite like there's many systemic, it's a systemic problem. It's not any one thing. But I would say to brands, if you're thinking about women sponsoring women's sports, do it right now. Now is the best time, because once you get in early, you're going to get those dividends.
Absolutely right. Now, your journey to come back to you, Dawn, before we release you back onto your bike, has been really diverse. Bike packing across countries, not a term I'm familiar with, mountain bike racing. What would you say to people, and women in particular listening today, who might feel intimidated by the idea of starting cycling or indeed any adventurous sport?
I would say just get started. Find any, like there's a lot more information out there now than you know, when I initially started. You can look up our podcast, the Metal Set podcast or the Just Bikes podcast, and there's a wealth of information there. But just get started. There are many groups here in the UAE now that are taking women from learning to ride a bike.
That's what I wanted to ask you. Are they?
Yes.
Because I always feel like that's a real men in lycra situation, and I'm like, how would I feel comfortable going along in leggings and a t-shirt going, guys, can you show me how to change gears? I'm not going Al Qudra at one speed.
There's UAE Team ADQ, which is the women's pro team that is based here, and they've started a program called Women Moving Forward. So they will actually take you from not knowing how to ride a bike to riding in a Peloton. And I think I saw a couple of days ago on social media, some new cyclist has just finished their first 90K ride, you know, going from non-cyclist to riding that. So there's a lot more resources out there now, but just get started. Don't be afraid when anyone thinks.
Message here saying, how to spell the podcast. Podcasts. There's Metal Set, as in showing your metal. So M-E-T-T-L-E-S-E-T. And then Just Bikes podcast, which focus on kind of underrepresented stories in sport, but particular endurance cycling. Mm-hmm. Dawn, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having
me. With your permission, if people want to send me a bike emoji, can I share details of what you've got going on?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Please.
Let's do that. If you want details of the podcast or indeed our guest this hour on World Bicycle Day, Dawn Barnable, send me the word bike or bike emoji. I'll know what you mean and I'll send you those details so you can feel inspired, hear some amazing stories, and maybe even hop on a bike yourself. Dawn, what's next for you, lastly?
Oh, I've got a race coming up in Neom in November, the Titan Desert Race, KSA Titan Desert Race.
Keep us posted.
Mountain bike race.
You're a star. Thank you so much. Queen David Bowie now here on Dubai i103.8. As I said, we love introducing you to inspiring people, hearing their stories, and if we can facilitate conversations and raise profile. And as Dawn's talking about there, such an interesting and important time for women's sport.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer on Dubai i 103.8.
With House and House, 10 years of unlocking opportunities in Dubai real estate.
It is your property clinic now. We have stolen away from a very busy day. Matt Solomon, who is sales manager for House and House, specialising in Palm Jumeirah in particular. We're talking about buying, living on the Palm. Matt, how are you?
Very good. Thanks for having me.
Aren't you lucky to have such a great area?
Very lucky, yeah.
Because when we think about Dubai, we think iconic.
Yep.
We think skyline, and we definitely think Palm Jumeirah.
100%.
So what I want to kind of talk today a little bit about is the offering in terms of what's available, different property types, even different kind of quote unquote areas on the Palm. And then we're going to come to the text line as well.
Okay.
So if someone had just landed in Dubai
and
they're thinking about the Palm as a place to buy and live, ideally, what are some of the main points that you would be communicating to them about you know, quality of life, and also the investment piece as well, you know, really important?
Okay. Well, from a point of view of living there, I've lived there for most of the 8 years that I've been here, and I've worked in the area for the entirety of those 8 years, so I am a little bit more than just biased.
Well, no, but that's a brilliant testament, isn't it, that you're the living embodiment of this part of town?
Absolutely. I bought there in 2021, so I've lived there happily as well. One of the things I find most fascinating about the Palm, it isn't all the luxury side, that is an element of it. It's more how much there is to do. Mm-hmm. So it's great for young families. Within very, very close walking distance, you can be on the beach, either West Beach or on the other side on the shoreline. You've got the park, you've got two shopping malls, if you include the Galleria. So like from where I live on the trunk, within 10 minutes on foot, I can go for a bite to eat on the beach. I can go and sit by a pool. I can go to the cinema. I can go and do my weekly shop. I can go and meet some friends for some lunch. I don't know anywhere in the world, let alone in Dubai, where you can do that so freely and so easily and have the added sort of cachet, I guess, of knowing and feeling like you're in one of the most prestigious places on the planet, one of the few places you can actually see from from up above.
That's a really good point, actually, about that quality of life, about when you're on, because you know, I know this with friends who live there, and yep. I know we talk about community quite a lot, and I feel like the word can lose a bit of meaning, but this is what so many people say, is that, you know, our kids have got friends in the next tower. Our nanny has, you know, has her group of people that she can meet up with the kids, or, you know, got her own social life going yep. on. I really feel like the restaurant game has been massively upped over the last few months. I mean, it's always been these, you know, big hotels and some fantastic places in those properties. But when you look at the, you know, the rooftop with, you know, the likes of Shea Wham and Signor Sassi, yep. and, you know, this, it really feel like it's making its mark on that point. You know, it always comes back to food with me, Matt.
Yeah, well, 100%, and it's all really high quality stuff as well. You know, that Signor Sassi is one of the best Italian restaurants I've ever been to.
Oh, shall we use the text line? Can we talk about money, money, money? Yep. Message when we're talking about, and I do think of the Palm being a luxury commodity in terms of certainly those villas and of course some apartments as well. But message asking, is a family looking to purchase and live there, if we're looking between the 3 and 4 million mark, yep. what would you be able to get for you? What bang are you getting for your buck?
Well, you would most certainly be on the trunk. So from a location perspective, a community feel, great for families like the area I've just described where I live, that would be where your budget would push you towards. 3 mil, so assuming if it's a family, it's got to be a 2-bed with a maid's, not a 1-bed. Then introductory level would be around 3 mil for sort of a road-facing Golden Mile or on the shoreline. Obviously, if you nudge that up to, say, 3.5, you could get something with a park view or maybe even a water view in Marina Residences.
I love Marina Residences.
Such good value for money. Where else in the world can you buy somewhere for that kind of price per square foot with a water view, direct access to a shopping mall and on the Palm Jib? It's just crazy.
The balconies. I've got a couple of friends that have bought a Marina Residences, and we've always just had such great, like, you know, Christmas dinners and nights out. The balconies yep. are brilliant. You know, views of the marina and the pool. So you might get something between 3 and 4 in maybe Marina Residence or you know, that kind of trunk area.
100%. I mean, at 3 would be introductory level. Obviously, nudging towards 4 would be where the sort of the view would get slightly better or on a higher floor. And then for a 3-bed, you'd probably struggle at the 4 mil, but again, if you could sort of nudge that up a little bit closer to 4, 2, 4, 3.
Can I ask you about the age of some of the properties on the Palm? And if someone's looking to sell in particular, what are some of the advantages to selling as is versus doing either a superficial kind of renovation, okay. you know, your wraps, your floors versus a full? When you're going in and looking at values, what can really make a difference?
Honestly speaking, I think with stuff like wrapping and sort of minor renovations, it wouldn't usually add a huge amount to the actual resale value, because at that level people would probably be more inclined to do their own. Mm-hmm. So I always advise my vendors, if you're going to sort of do some titivation to sell it, don't go over too much, because the likelihood is someone will want to go and do their own and make their own mark on it, especially in like a 2 or 3 bed apartment, because the time and cost to do it, it's all relative, of course, mm-hmm. isn't that off-putting. When you look at a 5,000 square foot villa, it's millions of dirhams, whereas in a 2,000 square foot apartment, it's hundreds of thousands. And that's to do a really nice, mm-hmm. really nice job. So I always say, don't do that. Sell it as it is. Just make it as presentable as possible.
Yeah, neutral, all-encompassing. Yep. Oh, I want to ask, because we've had a message asking, what are the advantages about purchasing a ready-renovated okay. property over buying standard and doing it yourself? So putting your kind of buying hat on, what would you say to that point?
I mean, there's pros and cons for both. Mm-hmm. I would say the advantage to buying fully renovated is you don't need to do any of the work yourself. You can move in.
But you might not like it.
Yeah, most renovated properties are also sold fully furnished. Mm. So there can be a full turnkey option. So there is an advantage. You will pay a premium for that, obviously. You've got to factor in as well, if you're doing your own renovations, there's a certain amount of time where you probably can't live there. So are you going to have to spend more money on rent? Are you going to live in another property that you own and not be able to rent it out? Mm. So there are lots of other costs as well.
Matt Solomon with us today. He's the man with the finger on the pulse of the Palm.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer on Dubai Eye 103.8.
With House and House, 10 years of unlocking opportunities in Dubai real estate.
People selling their apartments. Very nice job it was too. Quite yep. liked your flooring there. Thank you for sharing that. We also have had a message asking about Airbnb and short-term lets on the Palm. Laura, I'm going to send you the link for House and House Holidays, because that's kind of a separate thing. But I mean, my goodness, can I ask you from like an investment point of view, if people buy on the Palm and look at short and long-term rent, there must be some 100%. Great return there.
100%. Because again, most people who don't know Dubai that well, they just know the Palm, Downtown Marina, Burj Al Arab, Burj Khalifa. So if someone was coming to stay on a business trip for a month or a long weekend, I'd be willing to bet good money that the first place they would search for is the Palm.
Mm-hmm. Because it's that known quantity. And then you start looking at the quality of the build, and as you talked about before,
yep.
how easy it is if you're not looking to hire a car, you know, walk up the park, there's yep. the all of that. So do you yep. see that quite a lot? So when you're looking at what you're selling on the Palm, how much of it is for owner-occupied and how much is for investment?
Honestly, at the moment, I would say the majority is owner-occupied. The majority of the people that we seem to be dealing with at the moment seem to just be, you know, relatively sort of normal families looking to buy a family home, looking to move in. A lot of people that already live on the Palm, they might have rented for a certain amount of years and decided,
This is it.
I want to get my own place. I've been here a few years and I want to renovate it and make it my home.
What about that very top end of the market, Matt, when we feel like we're on Dubai hustle? Have you seen any mega mansions that have really wowed you?
Yeah, I mean, we're working on quite a few at the moment. My main focus at the moment from a sales perspective is on the villas. And I have a team around me, obviously focusing mainly on the apartment side, on the Trunk and the Crescent. So yes, I'm in and out of a lot of these unbelievable villas.
Can I ask you about The Point?
Yeah.
We had a messenger saying, I've heard and seen that The Point is closing down. What's mm-hmm. going to happen? Will it reopen? What's the word on the street, Matt Solomon?
Oh, I can give you the official answer. So it's obviously slowly winding down. They got served the notice, all the tenants with the restaurants, approximately a year ago. Mm-hmm. And a few are still operating, I believe, but it's slowly winding down. So Nikhil, the master developer for The Palm, they're developing a small cluster of villas. I think it's 56 villas and or plots. And they were all sold off market, no pre-launch, no launch to VIPs and royals.
I wasn't invited to this pre-launch.
No.
That no email arrived in my inbox, Matt.
No, I'm same.
Outraged.
I didn't even know it was going to happen
wow.
until it happened. So one of my contacts at Nikhil, I just said, you know, what is happening? I've heard it's going to be villas. Obviously, we're keen to get involved and try and sell a few. And he was like,
done and dusted, mate.
All gone. Sorry, mate. Yeah, pretty much.
So are they going to be pretty spectacular?
Again, because nothing's been sort of officially launched.
Location-wise, it's incredible, right? Location will be great.
I assume, and I could be wrong and I shouldn't assume, there would be a similar style to what they're doing in Palm Jebel Ali, which is a lot more modern and slightly bigger than the current standard homes they have on their fronts.
When you look at what stock you've got right now, and I'm seeing in many a Facebook group that people who are wanting to buy are like, there's just not that much around. Can you still bag a bargain on Palm Jumeirah, and whether that is for investment or indeed for getting a good return as an owner-occupier? And what kind of property type, last question to you, Matt, should you be looking at?
Honestly, in the current market, with it being so strong, with it being so active, finding a deal isn't easy. I'd never want to say you can't, never say never. But if anything did come on the market under market value, you wouldn't even know. It would just literally be snapped up straight away.
But this comes back to the importance of having a good relationship
yep.
with individuals such as yourself
yep.
who can say, oh, Helen, just an FYI, hasn't gone on yet. Mm-hmm. If you're ready to move, it's ready to go.
And that's what we tend to do. Before we put a property live, we often spend time chatting to current buyers that we've got just to try and get some activity, some viewings, so we can also give good, honest feedback to the vendors.
Thank you so much for your time.
No worries.
Very interesting. I also want to know, but when I see these Point villas when they come out. Watch this space. On hand to guide us through the headlines, take my questions, but most importantly yours, we've got Tenji Moyo, partner at Gately Legal. Tenji, how are you?
Very well, thank you. And it's good to be back.
It's lovely to have you in the studio. Before we get to the text line and indeed social media, a lot of people reaching out on Instagram messaging as well today. Now, it was just end of last week, 30th of May, the new mental health law came into play. Can we outline, please, no disrespect, in ways that I will understand what the new mental health law is in the UAE and what you predict your impact could be on the employment world as well, Tenji?
Yeah, I think it's really groundbreaking for the employment scope, because what it now means is that an employer cannot terminate an employee because of a mental disorder. What's quite interesting, I think, with the new law is that the definition is really quite wide. So any mental health disorder that impacts someone's kind of social or personal activities. Before, what used to happen is, you know, once someone has exhausted their medical sick days, off they go. But that doesn't apply when there's actually a mental, health issue. So now I think we need to probe a little bit more and perhaps put in policies for potential long-term sickness.
That's really interesting. Yeah. Now, I obviously can't speak to the UAE because I haven't got the numbers on that, but there has been some an awful lot of data out of the UK about just how many people are on long-term sickness, which, you know, I feel like there's needs to be a conversation about how this can unfold, you know, impact on colleagues as well, but ultimately about protecting people who are vulnerable, who have had a diagnosis, who are in genuine need of making sure they're getting the help that they need.
Yeah, and I think it goes a long way to remove the taboo and the stigma of mental health. I think historically, a lot of employees will want to hide that they're suffering from maybe depression or other disorders. So I think it's really great that there's protection and employers can no longer simply say, well, you know, your sick leave is gone, off you go. And I think it really puts a duty of care, the onus of duty of care for employers to look at initiatives to take care of their staff, which will include mental health.
Interesting. We just need the insurers to get up to speed as well and start offering a bit more therapy as part of packages. Just saying, people, we are seeing some.
We are. We are seeing more.
Not as much.
I mean, what a lot of people don't actually know is that there are employee assistance programs with their medical insurance. So people actually need to see what's actually covered because there are really good packages there with counselling services and so forth, which is completely disconnected from your employment.
Do you know what I find really frustrating, and I say this because I'm in weekly therapy, is the paying claim. It just kills me.
I have to agree, but I must admit that I didn't know the benefits that I had until COVID, the pandemic, when, you know, we were all sent home and we were given this card to say, if you have any issues, call.
Wow.
Only then did I realise that I had this benefit. So people should check.
Yeah, dig a bit deeper. You never know what you might be able to access there.
100%.
But I think you're right in terms of destigmatising. And when it comes from labour law, when it comes from government directive, companies really need to sit up and pay attention. And I think it gives a bit of power back to the employee in saying, you know, you might have a company culture, you might have a boss that's, you know, this personality type or dismissive or isn't understanding, but this is the letter of the law and this is what I'm entitled to. So that came out 30th of May last month, new mental health law here in the UAE. If you've got any questions, any clarifications, do reach out. I came back from the UK last week and summer had arrived, Tenshi.
Yeah, really?
Good grief.
It's arrived here.
It definitely has. Oh no, in Glasgow, I think we had about an hour of sunshine, but I got back and thought, crikey, I've only been out of the country 3 days and I feel like, you know, the temperature had been amped up. Which is why I wanted to talk to you about summertime working hours. When does this come into play? Who falls under those guidelines? And what are some of the fines attached to companies that aren't following those guidelines?
Yeah, it's really important for all employees to take care of their staff. But the official dates, 15th of June, no kind of outside working, mainly for labourers, you see, are working under extreme conditions. Between 12:30 and 3 o'clock. So that's when the sun is at its highest. And we know.
Down tools.
Absolutely. Down tools. Make sure there's enough shaded area, cooling area, water. The obligations to make sure people can work. Okay. So
that's the 15th of June. As I said, Tenshi Moyo in the studio today taking your questions and mine. We are going to go to the text line next. We've had messages about getting out of notice periods early. We've had questions about being asked to resign instead of being made redundant. Is that legal? And also mergers that have resulted in a role being completely changed. Can they force these changes on me without any documentation or official acceptance?
Dubai Eye 103.8 presents an array of independent expert opinions and does not advise one particular view. Always seek independent legal advice which considers your own personal circumstances.
Joining us in studio this afternoon to guide us through employment law, she is, I mean, the amount of information in this woman's brain absolutely wows me. Tenshi Moyo is with us today, partner at Gately Legal. Are you ready for some text messages?
Let's have some.
Okay. Message from Daniela, and you can put your name on your messages or you can be anonymous, makes no odds at all. Daniela's husband was made redundant last week. Company is asking him to resign instead of making him redundant. Company's in trouble. They have let multiple people go. His tenure is less than a year. Is this legal?
Well, it always makes sense to leave under the correct reason for leaving. One of the things that I'm concerned about is the insurance, unemployment insurance. That only pays out if you are terminated and not when you resign. So potentially, I mean, if he's under a year, maybe he hasn't got the full premium. But if he has paid for the premium, because the premium follows you, mm-hmm. then that would impact his ability to claim on the insurance. So I'd be mindful about that. A lot of employees request resignation simply because they think it looks better when they go to their new job and say, I actually resigned as opposed to being terminated. But I wouldn't be too concerned about, redundancy. Many employees don't tend to cast a cloud over that. So
does it have an impact on gratuity, Tenji?
It doesn't. No, I mean, because he's worked under 12 months, he's not really entitled to it anyway, unless he's in the DIF. And perhaps they've been making contributions monthly under dues. I think what the employer is concerned about more than anything is a potential claim for mm-hmm. arbitrary dismissal and so forth. I wouldn't recommend it under those circumstances.
Okay, Tenji Moya with us today. Lots of questions coming in, gratuity questions. I mean, you're talking there about arbitrary dismissal. How about this one? Anonymous on 4001 saying, long story, but my company has merged with another. There's been restructuring, many changes, redundancies as well. I haven't been made redundant. My salary has not changed, but everything else has. Title, role responsibilities. Can I, do I have to accept this? I want my redundancy payout. Can they force these changes on me without documentation or with an official acceptance on my part?
Well, no, it sounds like a fundamental variation to a contract, especially if the legal entity is changing. So the long and short of it is, if it's a fundamental change, then no, it cannot be imposed on you. She would have to sign her new employment contract and terms. Where we have mergers, we tend to find a contractual arrangement to transfer benefits from the old employer to the new employer by way of what we call a tripartite agreement, where three parties sign it. So I would negotiate. If there's a fundamental change, then it's an opportunity to resign and get her dues and okay. look for something else.
Hope that helps. Here's someone who's resigned but is no longer in the country. Daly's been in touch saying, asking for a friend, honestly.
Yeah.
Don't worry, Daly, it's fine. Daly says she's already resigned from her company, did not tender notice. She left the country for good due to urgent matters. Can they file absconding even if she's already abroad, or is it applicable just to those in the UAE? Thank you.
Yeah, so absconding is only when you're here and you've disappeared. Once you leave the UAE, we can't actually file an absconding notice against you. So I hope that answers your question.
What about coming back to the country, though?
When you come back to the country, if the company's filed some sort of claim against you, then there might be implications. So sometimes there are unpaid loans, there's some sort of court judgment against you, then absolutely it will impact you. But absconding notices, the individual should have absconded in the UAE.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. Hope that makes sense, Daly. Do feel free to share this podcast with your friend. You can hear it internationally, and I hope she's okay. We've had many questions about gratuity and contracts coming to an end. We're going to be coming to those in just a few minutes. Tenji, I wanted to ask you a little bit. We touched on earlier the new mental health laws and the impact on employment. But what about diversity, equity, inclusion, some of the initiatives that are taking place there? What are you either seeing or looking to initiate yourself in this space? I feel like it's a conversation that is rightfully really hotting up.
Yeah, it really is. And I think companies are looking at more family-friendly initiatives. We're seeing, as we spoke about mental health, we're seeing so many initiatives such as companies paying for gym membership, sports membership, counselling, as we've spoken about. Remote working is getting easier. And we spoke about the abuse. So as long as it's not being abused, mm-hmm. it's great. We're seeing a lot of initiatives for the promotion of women in the workplace, training. So it's a fantastic time. And those really forward-thinking organisations are taking it up. I mean, at Gately, we've just recently introduced an audit for companies to really check their own data, a DEI audit check. And with that, they're really able to see how far they are up in the journey.
That's
because
interesting.
It's a journey,
but
isn't
presumably,
it?
Presumably, just to play devil's advocate, companies are already feeling engaged in this conversation might be quite keen to seek out that counsel and improve, whereas I'm sure there's a whole raft of companies that couldn't give a monkey's and don't want to be audited in any way. It's almost like you want to be going to, you're the ones that need our help.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's just about a sense check about where you are, and some organizations don't know how to begin.
Yes,
so you know, sense. if you don't do an audit, you don't know where you are in the journey.
And presumably, if you've got lots of legacy staff members,
absolutely. Have you got grievances? Have you done training? What type of initiatives can you bring in? What are employees looking for to retain them? We know the companies that have these initiatives are the ones where employees stay longer and are more profitable. So it's a circle, isn't it?
So can people reach you if they want to?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Tell you what, if you want to send me the word inclusion,
I will
send you the details of that. Tenji Moyo is in the studio today, partner at Gately Legal. We are talking about employment law in particular today. We've had questions about will my vacation be paid for if I resign? We've had messages about nanny gratuity as well, and notice periods too.
Dubai I 103.8 presents an array of independent expert opinions and does not advise one particular view. Always seek independent legal advice which considers your own personal circumstances.
Joining us in studio to look behind the headlines and, of course, go to the text lines, we've got Tenji Moyo, partner at Gately Legal, talking employment law. And many a question coming in anonymously and on social media. Tenji, a message here saying, a guy's been made redundant, head of a division at an electronics company, but someone has been placed in the same post. Can he file a complaint?
Yeah, I think there's definitely grounds for complaint. For a redundancy, it really should be a genuine redundancy. We know the UAE courts rely heavily on experts. So I think when you have a claim and the expert would confirm that it's not an economic reason, you simply put someone else in, there's definitely grounds for it. However, saying that, we know under the new labour law, redundancy is recognised. So we're seeing it more and more than perhaps historically. Mm-hmm. And also the ability to claim unfair dismissal is perhaps a little bit more difficult now, because what you find in the law is there's an expectation to file a complaint before you actually, you know, win. So we're finding less and less employees actually winning these claims.
If they did want to file a complaint, what is the process? Who do you go to, Tenji?
Yeah, so for an employment matter, what you really need to do is file a claim with either the Ministry of Human Resources and Emiratization, or if you're in the free zone with the Labour Department, what they will try and do is mediate the complaint between the employer and the employee and see if you can actually reach a consensus of sort. And then if there's no agreement, then it goes to the Labour Court.
Okay. Tenji Moyo with us today. Got an awful lot of messages about people leaving companies.
Oh.
Okay. So let's help out this one. One is about a nanny. Anonymous message saying, our nanny's resigned after 2 years, 10 months. She's saying she's entitled to 3 years gratuity, which I'm freaking out about. It's going to cost a fortune. What does the law say? It's really stressing me out.
Yeah, so domestic workers isn't actually covered under the UAE labour law. But on my last check, there is a gratuity. It is 14 days. As far as I'm aware, it's 14 days for every year of service. So I'm afraid there really is a gratuity for nannies.
Rightfully so.
Rightfully so. After three years, you know, so there is that really that expectation.
I've heard from a number of friends and seen actually quite a few posts on social media about nannies asking for an advance on their gratuity. Maybe it's to pay for something back home. I mean, some of them unfortunately have been, you know, falling prey to loan sharks here as well. If you do decide that that's something you're able to offer, should you get some kind of an informal or formal piece of paperwork done to say, you know, we have paid out X amount based on this number of times served, and then, you know, the clock resets again? Or is it kind of a between the family thing?
Yeah, look, I always recommend, as I would anyone else, to have some sort of contractual document in place. If there is an advance and the agreement between the parties is it would be deducted from gratuity, then absolutely it should be agreed and signed. And there's a binding document in an agreement, and that's fair play.
Lots of questions about notice and gratuity, Tunji. So let's help this listener out, because I know they're listening right now. It's just come in the second.
Okay.
My employment contract states I must serve a 3-month notice period.
Yeah.
But labour law states only 1 month is enough. Can I serve only 1 month and still get my full gratuity?
Well, notice and gratuity are two different points. If they have agreed 90 days, then they must work the 90 days, or they would need to pay compensation in lieu of notice. So if it's 90 days and they work 30, then they would need to pay 60 days compensation in lieu of notice.
How's the 60 days calculated?
So because the notice period is 90 days and you only work 30,
it would be
based on your salary. Yeah. So your basic salary and your allowances, so you'd pay that compensation to the employer. It doesn't impact your gratuity. Your gratuity will be calculated on your length of service up until your last day. Mm-hmm. So if you work 30 days of your notice, then that termination date would be the termination date. Then you would calculate it from your first date of employment. Very important to work your notice, unless the parties can agree mutually to waive it, or you pay compensation in lieu of notice for that. It's a penalty.
Interesting. Yeah, because let's be honest, a month actually isn't that long to find someone to replace a role.
Well, absolutely. And also 30 days is the statutory minimum. The parties can agree a longer notice period. So you find with more senior employees, they get 90 days. And that's really because it takes longer to replace them. And also there's a longer handover period. So it really depends from place to place.
And check your contract.
Absolutely.
When might someone get those magical words, "We're going to put you on gardening leave"?
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. I've got a friend on gardening leave right now. He might not still be my friend in a few months because I'm getting really sick of what a lovely time he's having.
Oh, wow.
when might that be something that's suggested by a company, Tunji?
So companies use it a lot, especially in quite technical sectors when you want to actually keep the employee in the garden away from the market, right? So when someone resigns, a company has the authority to decide whether or not they want you to work the notice. But if they still want to bind you to the terms and conditions of the contract, they will put you on garden leave, you stay in the garden. And if for any reason they need you to help out, hand over and so forth, they will ask you. But you are not permitted to work for another employer during that period. You are still bound under contract. That's very important.
My words to him, are you going to get fat or are you going to get fit during this time? He's not in the
fat
garden.
I hope.
He's in the gym.
Dubai Eye 103.8 presents an array of independent expert opinions and does not advise one particular view. Always seek independent legal advice which considers your own personal circumstances.
Tunji Moya with us in the studio. We're going to have a little quick fire round on the text line trying to help out as many people as possible. She's a partner at Gately Legal, specialising in employment law. And a message here saying, I need legal advice on how I can respond to a letter of work suspension for 30 days without pay due to an investigation taking place. I already received a notice letter through email from my general manager, really seeking your advice. Sounds serious.
Yeah. Suspension is actually supposed to be with pay whilst the investigation is going on, if the company decides to do it. Under the UAE labour law, suspension is actually a penalty. It's a sanction that should happen after going through a process, a disciplinary process. And afterwards, if you feel the employee has undertaken the misconduct, then you say you're suspended. And the maximum is actually 14 days.
Not 30.
No, it's not. So I would definitely look into that.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
Gratuity. Okay. Yes. Number of questions. Anonymous one saying, I've completed 11 years in my current role on June 30th. I'm currently searching and interviewing for a new job. If I hand in my notice before June 30th, and obviously work my 1 month notice, am I still eligible for the 11th year gratuity, or do I need to hand in my notice after June 30th to get that? Oh,
so gratuity, you don't have to work your anniversary for gratuity. Gratuity is pro rata. So as long as you finish 1 year, then it's pro rata. So it's calculated to the day on a pro rata basis. So don't really worry about the exact date at which you leave. But yes, everyone is entitled to end of service gratuity.
And a message here saying, are gratuity and repatriation legal requirements of all UAE employers? Can they deduct gratuity from your monthly salary like other countries do for superannuation? Or is this an obligation on employers? Thank you.
Very good question. So gratuity is an employer obligation. And no, they should not be making any deductions for end of service gratuity as you work. In the DIFC, it's a monthly contribution, but it is still an employer obligation. So it's completely different to what you find in other countries. We have seen some kind of sophisticated arrangements, and a lot of those will fall down if they are tested in court. And repatriation, if the expat employee is going back to their home country, absolutely, then you must. But if the expat is staying on to a new job, then there's no obligation to repatriate or give a ticket.
Good question. Now, I have actually asked this listener for a bit more information, but let's go on what we have here, Tenji.
Okay.
Saying, I've found a better job opportunity and would like to resign June 30th, but my vacations are scheduled for July. Will they pay me for my vacations? The next school contract starts in the middle of August. So I don't know if this is a teacher, but I guess the question is, would your vacations come out of this time period?
Yeah, so you can still take your vacation or holiday during your notice period. So I'm assuming, well, the minimum notice period is 30 days anyway. So if you give your notice, you would then be on your notice period. As long as there are no issues or your company wants you to hand over, then you would still take your annual leave as normal.
And this question has just come in, so I have not briefed you on it, and I apologise. But this is how much I trust you.
Okay, let's go.
This is how much I believe in you, Tenji. Message saying, my friend was working for a hotel. She resigned in April, given 1 month notice period. However, got sick and did not go to work for a week as she couldn't afford to go back to the doctor. She sent a text and emails to HR to let them know. However, they reported her as run away.
Oh dear. Yeah, it's really quite unfortunate. It would be important to try and get some sort of evidence of illness. After 3 days, there really is an obligation to prove that you are sick. And absolutely, if you have an official proof of illness, whether or not you're in your notice is irrelevant, they're still entitled to their sick pay.
Okay.
Hope that helps.
It does. It does. How do you know all of this?
And 13 years, Helen,
and
here.
And how do you keep up to date with it? We did just touch on this, but this message had come into me earlier and we've got a couple of minutes left. So let's just recap it. This is around notice period. And this is something a previous listener got in touch with, saying, I've resigned, provided the 30-day notice as I'm extremely unhappy in my job. I'm being told by HR that I'll be penalised for not providing a 90-day notice period as per my contract. Is there a way to get it around without being penalised? I understand it's the law, but how can anyone be penalised if they're unhappy in their job and want to move forward? I provide the 30 days, which I think is a sufficient amount of time to replace my position. Could really use the feedback.
I suppose it's bad news that I'm going to, give. But, once the parties have agreed 90 days notice, then she really does need to honour that irrespective of how they feel about it. The parties are able to agree, as we said earlier, to waive that period, to say, okay, only work 30 days. If they both agree, that's fine. But if the employer wants you to do the 90 days notice and you do not, then you will have to compensate the employer for the time that you do not work your notice, because it's obviously expensive, handovers required, and that's why we agree contracts, right?
That's why you signed it.
Absolutely.
Last question, the message here saying, I know you just touched on maids having an advance on their gratuity, but can you get that as an individual? Okay, so we talked there saying, if your nanny, your helper comes to you and said, I could do with an advance on my gratuity for XYZ reasons. Are you able to do that as an employee in any company? And how would that then work on calculating again?
Look, it's not a right. It's up to the employer to decide to do it. End of service gratuity is called end of service gratuity because it's paid at the end of employment. However, we have come across situations where companies have said, look, we want to help this employee out. They have a life event and we want to pay them what's been accrued. on those cases, we would put a contractual arrangement in place to say, okay, we make this deduction, whatever the amount. At the end of employment, we will calculate what the gratuity is and then make a deduction of what's been paid out. Of course, it's the employer's risk to make that. So it's not an entitlement. What we don't want is everyone saying, I'm entitled to my end of service gratuity now, because you're not.
Tenji Moya, thank you so much. And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.